Hello and welcome to the latest Brewing Podcast. I'm Ben Gutteridge, Research Director here at Brewing Dolphin. And today, along with our Head of Strategy, we'll share Brewing's outlook for 2020, covering equities, bonds, currencies and commodities. I think it's an extremely thorough yet energised and fast-moving 20 minutes or so that we're sure you will enjoy. But first up, please listen to some very important disclaimers.
The value of investments can fall and you may get back less than you invested. Past performance is not a reliable guide to future performance. The podcast is not intended as investment advice. No investment is suitable in all cases. Any tax allowances or thresholds mentioned are based on personal circumstances and current legislation which may change. We or a connected party may have an interest in the securities mentioned or may act as principal or agent in those securities from time to time. The podcast content comes from diverse sources whose accuracy cannot be assured. The opinions expressed in this publication are not necessarily held throughout Brewing Dolphin. Investment in currencies other than your own means changes in the exchange rate will cause the value of your investment to move independently of the underlying asset.
Well, hello everyone and welcome to the final Brewing Podcast of 2019. Thank you very much to our listeners for your support this year. And we now use this time to express and share our 2020 vision. And we are delighted to welcome Paul Dannis, our Head of Strategy, to do that. Paul, how are you?
I'm good. How are you doing, Ben?
Yeah, very well, thanks. Oh, wow. So rarely do I get asked on the podcast. What a great start. Well, so the roadmap for this podcast, as I said, is our 2020 outlook. Paul will begin by describing global economic conditions and what that may mean for the dominant asset classes, equities and bonds. And then we'll perhaps look a little bit more regionally as to try and determine what our preferred areas are. So, Paul, let's kick off with the global economy. You know, this clearly has been a bit of a slowdown in 2019, but central banks have attempted to make conditions a bit easier, and perhaps we've got better geopolitical news as well. Are we feeling quite optimistic for next year?
Yeah. Hi, everyone. So, I think our base case view is that this budding but choppy so far recovering global economic growth momentum that we've started to see play out beginning in around August, September this year, we think there's a little bit more room for that to go on the back of partly the easing monetary conditions, specifically the decline in interest rates that will begin in Europe in 2018, early 2018 in the US toward the end of last year. So we think that's largely ushering in this new budding kind of growth upswing in the global economy. And we think with that, we're gonna see global corporate earnings, which are currently quite weak, also start to improve. So that combined with the fact that monetary policymakers are committed to remaining patient, keeping rates at very accommodative levels, we think that'll see equities continue to rally on a 12-month view.
Okay, so we have seen a lot of gains already in 2019. In part, perhaps that is on the basis that we're going to see some of the recovery you're talking about. Is it natural then to assume that because the recovery will take hold that equities will do well?
I mean, you want to obviously look at what's priced in. And I think, you know, for that reason, because, you know, it's like what Warren Buffett always says, you want to be greedy when others are fearful when others are greedy. And it certainly doesn't look like the dominant market emotion is currently fear based on the rally that we've seen in equities. So I think, you know, for that reason, generally speaking, equities do follow the economic cycle. They tend to lead the economic cycle by around 6 months. But as long as the global economy is expanding, monetary conditions are easy, the path of least resistance for equities is up. But the fact that, you know, sentiment and bullish sentiment toward equities is on the high side, depending on which gauge you look at, that suggests the magnitude of the upside from here is probably limited. So positive upside, but just not, we wouldn't expect to see ripping equity markets over the next 12 months.
So you've revealed that you believe central banks are going to remain pretty cautious on the interest rate policy, I guess meaning that they're unlikely to start hiking in 2020. Does that therefore mean that bonds are going to be a pretty pedestrian asset class? Is there some sort of bloodbath coming there, given what some would perceive as pretty rich valuations?
Yeah, well, I think, you can get, the bond market's likely to price in, eventually the inflation's going to come back, and then eventually central banks will start to raise rates to counter that inflation. So we don't think we're going to see central banks do anything meaningful on that front over the next several quarters, but the market's going to price in that eventually central banks do start to make moves. So to the extent that long-term bond yields price in the market's view for what central banks are going to do for throughout the duration of that bond, we think we'll see bond yields rise on the back of that occurring.
Okay, so I think so far, hopefully our listeners are actually being reassured on the basis that actually there's been some consistency of message. We have on this podcast yourself, Paul, have sort of shared some of those views. But before we get to the more granular regional preferences and explanations, what are the risks to that view that equities actually don't have such a good time of it in 2020?
Yeah. Well, lots of risks at the regional level. I think, at the global level, the two biggest risks would be the trade. So trade, being the biggest risk, and our base case view is that we would not get an escalation in the U.S.-China trade war to the extent that it acted as an insurmountable roadblock to this budding kind of mini growth upswing. But we wouldn't sort of pop the champagne just yet with regards to U.S.-China relations. So even though there has been this phase one trade agreement announced, so number one, China hasn't confirmed the details of that agreement, even though they have confirmed that there is an agreement. Number two, the targets that the U.S. have announced are quite aggressive in terms of what the Chinese have to do to kind of meet this phase one trade agreement. There's lots of skepticism whether they're going to be able to meet those targets.
Was that the amount of soybeans and agriculture products that they buy and things like that?
That's one of the big areas of skepticism. The amount of kind of purchases, the increase in purchases, particularly in agriculture, that we're going to need to see out of China in order to meet the commitments of this phase one agreement. And even if we do get to phase two, which is an open question, because you might see China sort of roll the dice and wait, or kind of stall getting to phase two until we get past the U.S. election next year in the hopes of getting someone less hawkish on the trade front to negotiate with. But even if we do get to phase two negotiations sometime next year, negotiations are going to be very tough because the U.S. is looking for China to make structural changes to its economy China will not give in quite very easily on these areas. So
trade is a risk to our bullish thesis. Some good news at the moment, but we must monitor the story.
Yeah.
What was the second?
The second risk would be, and this is a much lower likelihood of materializing, but if it did, it would be a big risk for equities. Would be that it would be inflation.
Yeah.
So our base case view is that given that inflation is a lagging indicator. And we're only just kind of the initial stages of this budding uptrend in global growth momentum. We wouldn't expect it's too early to see inflation.
And why inflation is such a big risk, just to sort of complete the...
Well, because then if inflation were to come back and that were to force central banks to raise rates earlier than the market is currently anticipating, that would be a big risk for the economy, and particularly for equity markets.
Right, and look, let's get into some more regional commentary then. In fact, I'd encourage our listeners to listen to last week's podcast, the post-election podcast, where we spent a bit of time with Paul talking about UK equities. But perhaps we'll just do a brief summary there now and then spend a bit more time on some of our other regions. But what is our sort of strategy, our thinking on UK equities at this time?
Yeah, so the backdrop for the UK has improved compared to a couple months ago. So, the UK is going to move past the first stage of Brexit and businesses will benefit from the visibility that entails. We're obviously not going to get the hard left policies of Jeremy Corbyn or John McDonnell, which was a big concern for for business in the UK, and we're going to get a mild fiscal boost. That said, you know, the UK still has to negotiate its future relationship with the EU, and we think the EU is going to be a tough negotiator because this is the first time any country is obviously ever looking, has ever looked to leave the EU, and the EU doesn't want to set a precedent that would encourage other countries that have a high degree of Euroscepticism to go down that same path. So we think the EU will be a tough negotiator. There's questions on whether we will get a deal next year, and if we don't, who knows what will actually happen, but you know, Boris Johnson is threatening to take the UK following the transition period, not extending that, and reverting to trading with the EU on WTO terms, which would have a detrimental effect on the UK economy. So
he's trying to make it sort of legislation, isn't he, that to legislate that we can't extend negotiations, and
yeah,
that sort of provoked a bit of fear in the pound, for example.
Yeah,
I mean, that he could play that out, but of course we would remind listeners that it is within the Conservative Party's gift to re-legislate and unwind that friction, and could still extend negotiations.
Yeah, exactly. But I think the main point here is that there's still quite a bit of uncertainty.
Yeah.
And against that backdrop, it's going to be difficult for the Bank of England to raise rates. And without the Bank of England raising rates, I think there's going to be, you know, limited upside to the pound. And you know, the implication is for UK equities versus the global equity benchmark, in common currency terms, without seeing a stronger pound, it'll be difficult for the UK to outperform. So we still think UK equities, in line with our bullish view on global equities, will go up in absolute terms. We just don't see the UK index outperforming the global index in common currency terms.
I mean, would it be a currency that I would expect to see a bit of volatility around, given this sort of toing and froing, and actually the quite combative negotiating sort of strategy of our Prime Minister.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Yeah,
okay, I'm relieved. Right, let's flip to the second equity market that dominates client portfolios. The second most important market would be US equities, obviously being on a fantastic run. Are you starting to get a bit more cautious on that region?
I mean, a decade-long run of outperformance versus the global equity index, and we're still overweight, and you know, we're hesitant to lean against this strong momentum too early. But it does look like this kind of run of outperformance is getting a bit long in the tooth, and is probably nearing its latter stages. So, I mean, a couple points to make. I mean, the U.S. dollar tends to behave as a defensive currency. So when the global economy is picking up, you often see the dollar depreciating against most other currencies. So to the extent that we expect the global economy to pick up, that should weigh on the dollar, which will weigh on US equity performance against the global index in common currency terms. And then the other factor is the sector composition of the US index. So which is, with its lower weightings in financials, higher weightings in tech, this would suggest that the U.S. Could underperform as global growth picks up and as interest rates rise, as that tends to benefit the indexes with higher weightings in financials and hurts the indexes with higher weightings in these long-duration growth sectors like tech, which the U.S. has high weightings in. And there's also the risk of the election.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, clearly there's a lot of variables and actually quite a long time between now and then, but do you have, what would be your perception of what the market is after out of the presidential election?
Well, I think, you know, the best, I mean, it's difficult to say. I mean, it's clearly going to be, the market would like to see either Trump win again or to see a centrist Democrat win. I mean, the worst outcome for the market would be to see one of the more progressive candidates of the of the Democratic Party, specifically Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders, get elected because of the sort of anti-business policies that they are pushing. I mean, it's a bit more of an open question between Trump and a centrist Democrat, because the centrist Democrats, they're all talking about raising taxes as well, but not as much as, say, the Elizabeth Warrens or the Bernie Sanders are. I mean, if you had Trump, you still have the kind of, you have the, you know, that kind of anti-trade leaning that he has. And but I mean, the centrist Democrats,
his,
as well.
His favorite foreign policy tool is clearly sort of tariffs. You know, he can just seem to deploy them or threaten to deploy them in all different directions, doesn't
he? Yeah, but there would be no tax rises under, you know, with a second kind of Trump term.
No.
So, it's more of an open question which would be the favored kind of result by the market, but it certainly wouldn't be one of these kind of Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders.
And it's still a long way away, but I note from a previous bit of research that you've been doing, actually their probability of winning or approval ratings has actually sort of faded a bit,
yeah,
hasn't it?
It has. And actually, you've seen the U.S. Equity market outperform as that as their chances of winning the U.S. presidency, based on the eyes of the betting markets that have gone down.
Okay, well, let's flip now to Europe, the sort of perennial underperformer. And it seems at the start of most years, strategists come out and say, this is the year that cheap European equities will outperform expensive U.S. equities. And every year, that sort of call falls short. Yeah. We've said we're not going to be taking too much off the table with the US, but we are getting a bit more positive on Europe.
Yeah, we recently upgraded Europe ex UK to overweight, and there's two main reasons for that. So the first is cyclicality. So since the global financial crisis, the euro has behaved as a pro-cyclical currency. So as global growth picks up, the euro should perform well. And again, we're interested in common currency returns. So when a currency is going up, that's good for that index in question. And then the second is the political backdrop in Europe has improved. And Europe has historically shown that it tends to do well when its members are converging rather than diverging. And we've seen a lot of convergence around the eurozone. If we are wrong with regards to our views on kind of Europe ex-UK market, we don't see a lot of downside, because if the eurozone economy or the German economy specifically were to stumble, I mean, the Germans have a kind of war chest of surpluses they've built up over the years, and they're ready to deploy fiscal policy. Also, the ECB does not really have scope to drop interest rates any further, and this has been something that's hurt their banks and their financial sector, which has kind of got an outsized impact on the European equity index. So we don't see a lot of downside in the event that we're wrong. There are risks to kind of that overweight position, one being trade. I mean, Trump has sort of got his rejigged NAFTA deal, which is the USMCA. We've got now this kind of simmering in U.S.-China trade relations, at least for now. So now the EU is sort of seen as the glaring, unreformed bad guy on the global stage when it comes to trade. So the risk is that in 2020, Trump kind of turns his trade focus to the EU. There's also clearly risks on trade relationships with the U.K. So that's one risk. Another risk is Italy. So Italy, you know, the good news there is that there's a pro-EU government in place, but it is a coalition between the Five Star Movement and the Democratic Party, which aren't sort of these natural, what you'd think would be natural kind of political partners. So if there were to be a breakdown in that relationship, you know, currently the most popular party in Italy is the League, led by Matteo Salvini, who has a more kind of anti-EU stance. So there is the risk that, you know, political conditions in Italy.
But there is some opacity there, isn't there, in the Liga's position? I don't think they wouldn't ever sort of campaign on a Euro breakup
But
I mean, obviously to Italy's benefits, bond yields have fallen a lot. So funding costs, that's a nice sort of year over year improvement stimulus.
Exactly. And that's the kind of convergence I sort of referred to that leads to Europe doing well, is when you're seeing kind of bond yields around the region converge to one another.
I mean, one risk that you sort of didn't quite dial in on was demand from China, you know, outside of the trade sort of tariffs. You know, it would be perhaps incorrectly my perception that internal demand is okay in Europe. There's lots of sort of people, you know, working. It obviously could be a bit better, but it's actually sort of external demand. You know, China hasn't bought quite so much of the stuff that Europe produces. Yeah. Machines, more so than LVMH handbags, I would say, in that instance. So, and that ties into perhaps an emerging market comment you might want to extend, is that China has been stimulating to offset some of the pressures that its economy has been facing. But actually, the level of stimulus hasn't necessarily been one, or doesn't seem to be, of the scale that has really reignited Chinese demand on the impact on global growth. So I don't know how you're reading Chinese demand and the impact it have on emerging markets, but also maybe some reference to Europe?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't, China, economic growth in China has continued to slow. And like you say, the authorities have been implementing stimulus measures, like cutting interest rates, cutting the reserve requirement ratio for their banks, cutting taxes, encouraging local governments, state-owned enterprises to do more infrastructure spending. But it hasn't been enough to offset the fallout from the trade war. So for that to occur and for growth momentum to pick up, you're going to need to see trade tensions ease. And you know, now we've got this phase one trade deal announced, there is some scope for trade tensions to ease. And there is, we are probably going to see more stimulus out of the Chinese authorities. So I think there is scope for mild acceleration in Chinese economic growth in the quarters ahead. And I mean, you know, in terms of what that means for emerging market equities, I mean, you know, we like to split the emerging market world into two regions, Asia ex-Japan and then EM ex-Asia, which are quite different from one another. And Asia ex-Japan,
sort of South America and South Africa and emerging Europe then, I guess.
Exactly, yeah. Emerging Europe.
Just a geography lesson for our listeners just throw that in for the Christmas prezi.
Yeah, largely emerging Europe, Middle East, Africa, and Latin America would be emerging markets, ex-Asia. So yeah, Asia ex-Japan has got leverage to, you know, the global economic cycle. You know, so our bias is to want, you know, to upgrade. We're currently neutral. But before we do that, you are watching how the risks evolve. And the main risk is that, you know, you do get this renewed flare-up in tensions between the U.S. and China, which would hurt this trade-sensitive region, and see the renminbi, the Chinese currency, weaken, which would weigh on the relative performance of that region. Hong Kong is also a risk, and we've seen as protests have escalated there, these have weighed on the relative performance of Asia ex-Japan equities. So, I mean, we think Asia ex-Japan equities will go up in absolute terms, but before upgrading to overweight, we want to kind of see more visibility on these risks. In terms of EM ex Asia, it's largely a play on commodity prices. Yeah. I mean, the big kind of heavyweight members of this index would be Russia, South Africa, Brazil, Saudi Arabia, Mexico. So you want to see commodity prices go up for this part of the emerging world to outperform. And I don't think it's a great time to take big bets on commodity prices. So we've currently got this region listed as ranked as a neutral. So I think it's going to go up in absolute terms. We just don't expect to see it outperform.
But I mean, with a marginally cautious view on the dollar and a marginally optimistic view on growth, perhaps they're sort of the same thing. That's not an unhelpful environment for commodities.
Absolutely.
And I guess it explains why we're not underweight.
Yeah, absolutely. Exactly. So in absolute terms, I think EM ex Asia and its commodity focused companies, we will see them go up in absolute terms. It's just, we're not quite convinced that we're, you know, at the point where they're going to start outperforming. I think we need to see kind of more evidence that global growth is picking up before we kind of get more bullish on commodities. But I think the path, you know, we are kind of moving in that direction.
Okay, well, we might come back to commodities, have a sort of a chat about gold in just a moment. But an asset class that sort of does seem to have been forgotten or doesn't seem to get a lot of time in UK press or is Japan, you know, where are you on that region?
Yeah, I mean, so Japan's obviously been in a deflationary funk for a long time, and you know, there's not really any major signs that it's going to emerge from this deflationary kind of backdrop. I mean, the government has recently announced a fiscal package to offset the impact of the recently implemented consumption tax. But this isn't a game changer, so I think the outlook for domestic growth in Japan is fairly muted. So in terms of Japan's equity market, it is a pro-cyclical index given its high weightings in industrials and autos. So it should do well as the economy picks up, but the yen is a very defensive currency. So, and it should depreciate against most currencies as the global economy picks up, which will weigh on UK investor returns in FX on unhedged terms. So it does seem like it's kind of, these are like offsetting drivers for Japanese equities. I mean, the cyclical composition being supportive, and then the fact that the yen is likely to weaken as growth picks up. being the negative. So we've got a neutral view on Japan relative to the global equity index. But again, given our bullish equity, global equity view, we think, you know, Japanese equities will be going up over the next 12 months.
I think it's sort of worth monitoring the corporate governance story that lots of people have talked so positively about, because I believe there is sort of policy that's coming in that asks the regulator to investigate those investors who, or seek permission if they are intending on somehow advising management. So a shareholder comes in as an external buyer and then has a vote. If they intend to influence management, then they need sign off from domestic authority. So I think there is a sort of a corporate governance tailwind that many have been talking about that needs revisiting. But right, that's my contribution. Well, final comment from you, actually, in terms of investment. What are we thinking about the yellow metal?
Yeah, I mean, gold. So the time really to be bullish on gold would be when real interest rates are declining, because gold obviously is an asset that doesn't yield anything. When inflation is rising, when the dollar is weakening, gold's obviously priced in dollars, and when risk aversion is rising. So we don't expect to see kind of any of these variables, you know, move in a gold favorable direction over the next 12 months. So while gold has a place in portfolios and should increasingly act as an effective portfolio hedge, for now we don't see a lot of upside to the gold price, because, I mean, yeah, real interest rates are not going to go down any further in our view. It's too early to expect to see inflation picking up. We still think it's probably a bit too early before the dollar starts to weaken. And also we think risk aversion is not going to pick up given, you know, our fairly optimistic view on the cycle.
Okay, well, we've covered a lot of ground there. That is a really helpful summary. Erudite as ever, Paul. I'll let you get on with your Christmas now. Where are you going? Are you going back to Canada, or are you staying in the UK?
Sticking around here for Christmas and then heading to the Alps for a few days, get some skiing in.
Oh, so, very jealous. Well, I'm staying in beautiful London for the duration. To our listeners, thanks very much, as I said at the top of the podcast, for your support and feedback this year. Please continue to offer us that in 2020. You can get in touch via SoundCloud or iTunes, leave a feedback on Twitter referencing hashtag Brewing Podcast. But other than that, we wish you a very merry Christmas break over the holiday season and a prosperous new year, and we look forward to bringing you new material in January 2020. Thank you very much.